It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Thanks for joining me today. On my last podcast, I mentioned my guest, Jenny Graham. In 2018, she embarked upon and completed a round-the-world trip by bicycle. This, however, was not just any trip. This was a Guinness World Record attempt, and break the record she did by 110 days. Her story from start to finish is detailed in her new book, Coffee First, Then the World, which was just released in the U.S. on June 13th. Her telling of her story is extraordinary. The story itself is extraordinary. And our conversation was so much fun. From her custom Shan bicycle to her zip-bottom Endura bibs, Jenny doesn't leave anything out of her story. We talk about her wardrobe because during her ride, she experienced all the seasons and ended up in the Southern Hemisphere in winter. We talk about her fears, like bears when she was crossing Canada. And we talk about how she raised the money to accomplish this amazing feat, as well as what's next for her. So go grab a beverage and find a comfy place to sit and listen. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest today. How is it in Scotland? I imagine you're home.
Oh, I am at home. Thanks so much for having me. And we have just got the most incredible weather right now. We've had this block of 3 or 4 weeks of wall-to-wall sunshine, which is very unusual for us. But everybody's mood is, much higher than usual.
I see. So this time of year in Scotland, what would it normally be like? I mean, obviously, we're getting some strange weather everywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not unusual to have sunny spells and for it to be warm, but the back-to-backness of it and for it not to rain. I mean, we're wanting it to rain just to put out. We've got some wildfires and, again, extremely unusual for this climate. So, just making the most of that out in the hills, out in the mountains, having a great time.
Having a great time. Nothing better. So I want to say, And you and I were speaking before we actually started the formal part of the interview. I don't, and all you authors out there, don't take this, don't be offended. I don't usually read every word of a book, but something about your book, Coffee First, Then the World, I picked it up just to begin looking through it before we made the date to talk. And that was it. I never put it down. I mean, literally, I read it in like 2 days, and in 12 and a half years, there have not been many books that I have gone through and enjoyed as much as yours, even though it was kind of harrowing in spots. Some of the stuff you've been through on this world trip were just amazing. So can we start with your background, where you grew up and how you became an endurance cyclist in the first place? Because it's not usual that I talk to women who do the kind of thing you're doing, which I'm very proud that you are doing.
Oh, thank you. I mean, firstly, that's just such amazing feedback. It's just I'm still getting used to people having read the book and then just sitting with what they have to say about it. So thank you for reading it. My background into endurance cycling was definitely not a linear journey. Do you know, like 14-year-old me was writing her own notes to get out of physical education in school. I was not that sporty kid at all. Didn't have a sporty family or didn't affiliate myself with sport. So I'm from the Highlands of Scotland. So I have plenty, like we always had plenty of rivers to swim in, you know, close to the sea, close to mountains and trees to build dens in. And so that stuff came very early on, that playing in the outdoors and adventuring in the outdoors. I feel like that was kind of in my DNA, if you like. But I didn't realize that I could get into sports in that way that weren't conventional sports until, like I said, I was 24. By then I already had my son Lachlan. He was going to school, and there was a 6-month course at Inverness College, and it just said, you know, it was an introduction to outdoor pursuits. You didn't need to any qualifications to get on it, and it was like a really like basic, I wouldn't come out with any qualifications either really, but it was just this introduction. And that 6-month course changed my life completely. I learned to ski, I learned to snowboard, learned to ride a bike, learned to navigate. It was just unbelievable. It just opened up this whole new world, and all of a sudden I knew that like I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be, you know, to get in about that. And that was the start of it for me, sort of getting into the hills, getting into the mountains, building up that experience. But the endurance side of things came much later, maybe like another 10 years on. I was riding bikes by then, but maybe 4 hours a week if I was lucky, you know, just go out mountain biking. But I came across a trail race, a bikepacking race called the Highland Trail 550. Now, they're very similar. It's very similar to the American equivalents of the Colorado Trail or the Arizona Trail or the Tour Divide, that sort of self-supported bikepacking grassroots. And that's when I realized that I could take this love of the mountains and traveling long distances or by feet, and I could take it on my bike. And then all of a sudden I could pass through these places on my bike. And that was the very start of the obsession for me about miles and getting fit enough to do that kind of stuff.
What year was that? When was
so that? I went to college in when I was 24. So that would have been 2004.
Okay.
And then in 2014, 10 years later, I saw my first track leaders page that has these races. You know, everyone's got a GPS spot tracker, has this race on it. And there was one woman, Iona Evans, she was in a pink dot. And there was one woman going around that route. And I was like, why is there only one woman there? I want to do that. And so in 2015, I went out, and that's when I had my first attempt.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Jenny Graham. She's written a book called Coffee First, Then the World. It is about her round the world record, and she smashed the record on her bike. It's an amazing story. It's a great book. It actually publishes June 13th, which happens to be today. That's the day we're speaking. It just worked out that way that I was able to catch up with her at home in Scotland. Okay, so you mentioned in the book, and I've read several of the books you mentioned, the history, like Londonderry, Annie Londonderry. She was a character. Yeah, around the world cycling. Going back into the 1800s, there were some men who did it. A couple of them got lost. David Hurley, he wrote a book about one of them, and then there was the Londonderry book. So how did those stories, or did those stories influence you and like make you even more interested in doing around the world trip?
Honestly, no, I didn't. I knew so little about it. I didn't know anything about these women. I didn't know anything about the history of it. The book that I read that in 2010 that actually introduced round the world as a concept to me was Mark Beaumont's book, The Man Who Cycled the World. And he'd gone out and he'd ridden self-supported around the world in like, I think maybe like 190 days or something like that. I can't remember now. And it was the first time that I sort of realized like, oh, that's a thing. Like that's like that sounds amazing. Like I remember thinking how good that sounded. But when I was reading his book, my current my current life was going to my work, taking my son to school, picking him up from school, getting him to birthday parties, and so my biking and outdoor life was like so far away from this man who just cycled around the world. You know, it was like a completely different life. So trying to imagine myself as that person was difficult, but it definitely sparked a bit of an interest. And I didn't find out about Annie until much later on, until I started researching, until I started researching for Round the World. And even then, I think it was only after when I came back that I could truly appreciate these stories. it was, I had to feel it. I had to go out there and feel that vulnerability. And then I'd have a sense for what a small sense of what it must have been like for a woman of those times to go out, regardless of what had happened along the way. But I think before that, I guess I was just maybe a bit naive to the pressures of that she would have been facing going out there. Yeah.
It's just mind blowing. Yeah. And I remember some of the things that Annie did, you know, like pinning things to her dress to, because there was a bet involved. I remember that. And I think when I talked to the author, it was really an interesting journey, but nothing like the way you describe what you went through. It's just, I'm telling you, it's remarkable. What was the previous Guinness record that you were trying to break? Because you didn't just break it, you like mashed it into the ground. But who had that record? And when was
it? It's a really interesting one. Two women have held the record before me. And the first one, Juliana Bowring, in 2012, just so extremely recently. And she was the only woman to go out and ride around the world in a record-breaking attempt with a continuous ride. So like mine, she started and everything was included in her time. Now she did things like she started with a support crew to start, like her friend was driving along with her at first, and then she was like, hang on, I can do this on my own. And then she was getting like bits of help along the way, but in as a whole, she was like, she'd gone out there and done that herself. Now when she set off, Guinness rules were that you didn't include the travel time and transit time in your record. And that changed by the time she got back and submitted her time. So it meant that her ride time was 144 days, but her overall time, including all her 52, 53, around that sort of like an extra sort of 7-8 days, extra week. But then in 2014, Paola Ganotti, I think I'm getting that pronunciation right, Italian lassie, went out to break the record with a full support crew. Now, Paola's record is controversial because she went out and, you know, had this like incredible ride, the bits that you can see that she did. And she came across, like she had an accident in America, and I think she broke her third vertebrae. She basically had a huge injury that meant she had to come off the bike, and she wouldn't recover for like 3 or 4 months. Now, the Guinness rules are that the clock doesn't stop until you make it back to your finish line. But Guinness decided to stop the clock and give her time to recover. So she had that 4 months off and then started again where her clock stopped and then raced to the finish. So officially, she then got the record. Now, the record that she set was 144 days, the same as Juliana's ride time. So it was just out there. For me, I was just like, right, 144 days, regardless, is the time I have to smash. You know, that's the time to get the record back on like a continuous run for a female to go around the world. So that felt important that it was brought back. And I think I think Paola did incredible to get back on that bike. Such a serious injury. It must have been such a head game for her. And, you know, really, my heart goes out to her. But I think in the world of endurance, and especially these like grassroots racing stuff, like you've just got to have a lot of integrity to your ride. And, you know, if something happens to stop your ride, then I feel like you need to stop the clock as well, or like that's the end of your ride, you know. So yeah, it felt important to me on a personal level to make sure that the female who had the record, it was actually a continuous run that they had.
Yeah, I can see where stopping the clock almost gives her the chance to start over and not have that previous however many days it was fatigue that starts to set in, which, you know, which became very clear. What was the total distance that you needed to travel? I know that there are very specific rules. You started at the Brandenburg Gate, you ended at the Brandenburg Gate, but there's something about the way you have to pass through. Is it longitude or latitude?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't quite understand that. Explain that.
Okay, so there's the basic rules for a ride around the world for Guinness to verify it is it has to be over 18,000 miles pedaled. And you have to go, your whole trip distance, including flights and transits, has to be the same or bigger than the circumference of the planet, which is like 24,900 miles. Then you need to travel in an easterly or westerly direction. And once you choose your direction, you have to stay sort of primarily in that. They've got degrees, I can't remember them now, that you're meant to stick within. You have to pass through two opposite points on the planet. So that makes sure you have to go to the southern hemisphere. And the bit about the, I'm going to say latitude, the bit right. about the latitude is that you're not allowed to cycle back over the same line twice. So that means you couldn't get nearer to the end and think, oh, I'm 100 miles short, I'll just do laps of this field. Like, you have to keep going in a continuous line. And so that affected me when I got to the end of China and I got to Beijing, because it overlaps Perth in Australia, where I was flying to. So if I cycled to Beijing, then I wouldn't be able to start in Perth because that would be an overlap of the lines. That's the bit that you needed to watch. And now we've said longitude and latitude so many times, I can't remember what one it is anymore. I think I'm right in saying latitude.
I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, it took me a minute to figure it out when I was reading it. I'm like, okay, what does she mean by that? But you're right. I think that is exactly what it is. How many miles? So you had a goal for each day. Your setup is something I definitely want to get into, but you had a goal for each day. What was your original daily mileage goal, even though it varied, of course, during the time?
Yeah. So I set out hoping to do 180 miles a day, so 300 kilometers a day, and that would take me in. And then I'd have like a few days to play with, and some days travel, and then that would take me in as 110 days. I'd finish in 110 days, and that was like I was pretty set on that when I set off. And it's so funny because I remember when I set off thinking, well, what could possibly get in my way to make that not happen? Like, I just couldn't imagine what could come up that would mean that I wouldn't be able to sit on the bike for 15 hours a day and knock out that averages.
Yeah, right. Well, we're going to talk about some of the things that made your mileage greater or less. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Jenny Graham. She's written a book about her world record, which she did make, Coffee First, Then the World. And we'll tell you how coffee fits into it. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I am speaking with Jenny Graham, the current record holder. I don't know how anybody's going to smash this record of a round the world Guinness record on her bike, starting in Germany at the Brandenburg Gate, ending in Germany at the Brandenburg Gate back in 2018. Her new book, Coffee First, Then the World, is being published today, June 13th. So you'll be able to get a copy. We'll let you know at the end of our conversation. So I want to talk a little bit about your equipment. Because it's not just you, it's the bike. And we all know that the bike is a mechanical thing and it needs stuff all the time. And I'm in the bike business, I understand. You had a custom bike built. And when I mentioned the name of your builder to my husband, who's also a custom builder, he goes, I know that name. Tell people about your custom bike, because we'll give him a plug.
Oh, amazing. So yeah, my bike, Little Pig, which is Shand Stushy. So a steel frame bike built in Scotland, a sort of gravel setup that with, you know, for comfort, but like a road sort of tires and wheels on it and stuff like that. I had Ritchie Logic components all over it, so like just to keep the weight down, because, you know, I had the steel frame, so carbon components and group sets. And yeah, she was just an absolute dream. My wheels were a deep section carbon Wheelsmith, the guy's called Wheelsmith. He hand builds them in Scotland as well. So, yeah, dream setup.
And everybody needs to know the color of Little Piggy.
Yeah, golden mustard.
You just can't miss her on the road.
Oh, you can't miss her. And she was like one of that bikes that looked really happy even in bad weather, because she was so shiny and that color was so, it was such a happy color that even in really miserable weather, if I'd, you know, left the bike and gone back over to her, gone into a cot cafe or whatever, and I'd come back to her and she was just like ready to go. Well, she just
probably
looked like she was smiling.
Probably sometimes more ready to go than you were, as I can remember some of the conversation.
Always.
I want to talk a little bit about your handlebar setup. You put aero bars on the bike, but they weren't necessarily just to be aero bars. Explain your cockpit, what you did there, because it was like a technological Rube Goldberg wonder.
It really was. I mean, it was my home, you know, it was my front room, and the world just became my window that I was looking out at. It was just beautiful. So I had these tri bars on, just like basic like ski jump sort of set up high bars, and then I put two sticks in the middle of the bars that then became shelves. So sticks, you know, just like it was actually of a wooden broom, and then just attached them onto the bars, taped them up, and then on them I could have like all my bike computers. I had three bike computers. I had my light on it, my sine wave dyno light. So then it also like charged all my things on it. I had a great big hair bobble tied around it, so it meant I could stuff things in it, whether food or jackets or what have you, and just like keep things in there. I had my phone on there when it wasn't on my pocket, if I needed it out for things, navigating. And it just became it was like my office, my front room. It was my resting. I had all my snacks on the handlebars too, so it was just like everything I needed.
You used Apadura bags, and we've spoken with the people from Apadura, and in fact I was looking at one that they sent us the other day. Very lightweight, and you didn't take like a rack and panniers. You had really didn't take much with you, and you wore everything that you had sometimes, like everything at once. Break down your wardrobe, if you would.
Brilliant. Yeah, I literally had absolutely no luxury items with me. Everything was had to have a couple of jobs. And I go away for a weekend now and I have like twice as much as I took around the world with me. So I had, my system was I had a pair of bibs, cycling bibs, that they were Endura bibs. So they had a zip in them, which made them really easy to go for a pee. And I had two of them. I almost didn't take a spare, but thankfully I did, because things would have got really grim if I didn't. And that was the only spare item that I had with me, was that other set of bibs. And then I had leggies. So, you know, the leggings, and they would do for sleeping in. They would do for like staying warm in the winter. I had quite a lightweight pair of trousers, like waterproof trousers. And then these like two seasoned cycling shoes that in the winter time I just got boots for and put the booties over them. And then on top, it just went from like, I had this string vest that I literally wore every single day. I've still got it, and it was white, and it is grim. It is more grim than you can ever imagine. But it was like my perma layer, you know, it was just always there. And then I had my cycling top. I had, let me think now. Yeah, I had my cycling top. I did take a pair of armies, but I never wore them, but they were my emergency and my head go-to. And then I think maybe my layers were, I had like an extra two warmer layers that I could put on. So a windproof and a woolly zip and my jacket, and I must have had a gilet as well. And then I also had in the bag my spare jammy kit that doubled up for my travel kit as well. So they were like lycra shorts, really lightweight lycra shorts that I'd use my leggies for if it was cold, and a little pair of down boots that my mum had bought me. And I only say that because, you know, they were, I should have taken woolly socks, but because my mum bought them for me, I felt really attached to them. And a woolly top and an extra base layer woolly top, and then my down jacket and a hat. And that was it.
And you wore a lot of that, all of that, some of the time, all at once.
Yeah, all of that except for my bed stuff. Yeah. So I'd always keep that in the bag. I would literally never take it out unless I was sleeping. But quite often I would have all my jammy kit and then wear all my cycling clothes that I had with me and then get into bed, because I had this two-season sleeping bag with me. In hindsight, it was the wrong bag to have because it was absolutely Baltic. At the time it was like, I figured if I had a bigger bag, it would take up more space and it didn't have two purposes. Whereas if I took extra clothes with me, then they had extra purpose. So
right.
That was the thing. Yeah.
So you ended up in the Southern Hemisphere in the winter.
Yeah, I did.
Yes, you did. And I actually had a customer/friend who was killed by one of those land trains.
Oh, whoa.
But they looked out for you. When you were on those roads in Australia that are just endless, and these big, long, what they call land trains are, you know, hooked together semis, basically. So was there any point in the trip where you were just so terrified you didn't know if you could go on?
There was points in the trip that I was really terrified, that I was really, really scared, particularly when I look back on my diaries. I was like, that was a hard time. But I never thought, I'm not going to carry on with this. I was always like, right, how do I work this out? Because I am going regardless. So how do I get around whatever situation it was? And in Australia, I really lucked out, like I say, with the road trains. They were like really looked out for me. And I felt like quite lucky that they had my back there. But in Russia, I didn't feel quite so lucky with the traffic. And it was full on. Yeah, that was the point that I really thought my life was in danger quite often throughout the day. So I decided that I would ride at night actually there, just so I'd be more lit up and the traffic would be a bit less heavy and that sort of thing. So that point, and actually when I came up to, you know this because you've read the book, but oh my goodness, I made such a big deal of the bears when I came up to Alaska.
I was gonna mention that. Jenny's afraid of bears, let's just tell the truth. Yes.
Yeah. And it's so funny because when I'm at home and I'm thinking about bears, I am 100% not scared of bears, you know. But when I was out there that tired and sleeping in the woods and all I had was this like bear spray, I was like, what am I doing here? And I kept seeing bears and all of a sudden it was real. I was like, oh no. Yeah. When I was reading back over my diaries for the book, I was like, I can't believe how focused I was on this.
You were focused on the bears in North America. I will agree with that. And not like I wouldn't be afraid. I would be afraid for most of what you did. I still think it was one of the bravest things I've ever heard about, read about. The story is just mind-blowing. Let's take another short break. And when we return, we'll talk with Jenny about the front half of the book title, Coffee First. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to dive right back into my conversation with Jenny Graham, Guinness World Record holder and author of the just-released book,
coffee first, then the world.
So, you know, we absolutely have to talk about coffee, right?
Yes.
So the title of the book is Coffee First, Then the World. What is it about coffee? I would think that being in Scotland, it would be tea, but no, it's coffee.
Oh, it's coffee all the way. I'm not sure I was so addicted to coffee before I left, but it became a mental crutch for me when I was away. And it became that part of the day that it was like a little luxury. It was comforting. It was a reason to stop pedaling. It was an aim to get to. And so it just, it became a focus, like a daily focus. And when you don't have, you know, you have to create your own focuses all the time when you're out there, because you can't just focus on getting around the world because it's huge. And you can't just focus on getting across the continent because it's huge. And sometimes you can't even read the place names that you're going to, or you've got no idea where you're going to. So you need to make your own landmarks. And for me, the daily one was coffee every morning that I got up. And that even sort of fell into the previous evening. So I'd quite often choose where I was going to stop the previous evening, even if it meant I had to ride until 2 or 3 in the morning, just to make sure that I didn't have to ride very far for coffee the next morning. Because if I could get coffee within like 5 kilometers of waking up, I would get out of bed so quickly, or out of my bivy bag so quickly. But if I had to travel for like half a day, then it was like, oh, like it's quite far.
Yeah, that's pretty far. Can you remember the best coffee you had during the trip?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the change in coffee. You know, I'd come across Russia and it was all black sugary coffee, like instant coffee, and often quite watery, but still, you know, it was what it was, or like service station ones. And I remember arriving into Australia and the first thing I did was order an oat flat white with a lemon drizzle cake. And I remember thinking, this is it, like I've made it now, I'm getting this coffee. And it was just an airport coffee, but it was just that change of like, you know, you're back to something that you can recognize again. So that was cool. But honestly, sometimes it didn't matter the quality of the coffee. It was like the moment that you were having it, it was the time that you needed it, it was the surroundings that you were in having it. So that a lot of things played into it rather than just the actual coffee itself.
One of my favorite parts of the book, and it occurred more than once, was the craziness that happened before you had to make a flight to wherever you, so, you know, and somebody would meet you with a bike box and you break down the bike and you fly onto the plane and you try to sleep and you, I mean, it was just, if it wasn't so serious, it would have been hilarious, but it was serious stuff. And I really, every time you had to fly somewhere, I'm like, uh-oh, is she going to make it to that plane or is she going to have to reschedule again? And that's one of the things that we didn't talk about at all, how this trip was financed, because it's not inexpensive for you to do what you did. You had bank card, you had all these money exchanges, you had all this technological equipment, you had mechanical equipment that broke down. How were you able to afford to do this trip?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I figured out early on that I reckoned I could do it with 15 grand. So if I could raise 15 grand, that would give me enough money that I'd be able to get last minute long haul flights. So I took like an average of what they would cost, 4 of them. And it meant that I'd be able to stay inside 1 out of 3 nights. So every third night have somewhere to stay. And it would mean that I could literally rock up to any restaurant, cafe, shop, and buy the food I needed without having to think about how much it was going to cost me. So, and then I would have a little bit in the tank for like every continent, changing tires and bike and, you know, bike components and things like that. So that would cost 15 grand. I got the bike, most of my equipment sponsored. So like brands like Endura, Shand, Apadura, Richie Logic would all gave me the kit for free. And actually every bike shop I went to get a full overhaul, like throughout the world, wouldn't take money for the components, wouldn't take money for what I was done.
Of course we wouldn't.
It's just mind blowing. And it's not just like, oh, can you, you know, fix my puncture for me? It's like a full, like half day's work for people. And they were just like unbelievably kind. And yeah, it was really, really touching. So I figured that. And then, so what I did was, I was at the time in touch with the Adventure Syndicate, who are a collective of women who were like out to do big adventures and telling stories. And they had a core lot of sponsors on board. So they had already made a film about the Tour Divide and they were showing it at a premiere. And then they asked me along to and said, look, you can launch your idea here, you can tell people about Round the World, what Round the World's going to mean. And by going along and doing that, I managed to get like about, I think, maybe $5,000 of the sponsorship covered with the Adventure Syndicate and their sponsors. And then I got another sponsor on board, again through a friend, an American like global communication company came on board. And I had different people like Cycling UK at a charity, and they were like, well, we'll promote it for you. And so, you know, it had all this sort of like ripple effect. And so then I had half the money and I was like, right, I've got half the money, like how am I going to get the other half? I can't do it. It was already a really tight budget to do it on that. I mean, of course I could have toured it on half of that, but I couldn't go for the record on that. So then do you know the Blackburn Rangers scheme? Do you know that? Like, is
no.
The American Californian brand
Blackburn?
Yeah,
Blackburn. Sure.
Yeah. And so every year they have this like ranger scheme, and they, you know, like you can apply to be a ranger and go and ride a route and share stories about it. And they give you tons of kit. So the year before, I'd actually won this Niner bike from this Blackburn Ranger scheme. And it was incredible. I went around the Highlands, did all this like work for them, piece for them. And so I had this bike and it was like the best bike I'd ever owned. You know, it must have been like $4,000 worth of bike, $5,000 worth of bike. And so I raffled it off. I went, you know, like 3 months before I was leaving, I put it out on Facebook, probably Instagram, and was like, right, I want to cycle around the world for £10 a raffle ticket. Your money's going to go towards me, like giving that a go and attempting it. And people just bought so many tickets and really got behind that. And that was the start of the momentum for me, you know, because it wasn't just like people giving me like money towards it. It was also the belief and the sort of vibe it had around it. You know, people were like, go for it, like really behind me, pushing me on. And it made it really special. And then we had a big fundraiser in Inverness and like raffled off the bike and did all that. And then that was it. I had the rest of the money. So I fundraised half of it and sponsored the other half. And yeah, because I definitely didn't have $15,000 to put towards it.
So did it cost $15,000?
Yeah, it did. It might have just cost a bit more because, you know, all these things get a bit muddy. And
yeah,
I think, you know, I was getting things for free and stuff like that. But pretty much it cost me that I spent about the $15,000. Yeah.
So the last thing I want to talk about is the ending and then what's next for you. Talk about cycling back into Germany and how that felt.
I mean, back into the Brandenburg Gates, you know, for the whole time I was out there. I've got Stan Laughlin. He was 19 at the time. In fact, no, he just turned 23 days before I was finishing. He was out there with his girlfriend, my mom, my dad, my sister, and like all like my friends were starting to arrive. I knew all this was happening at the Brandenburg Gates. And then I was like riding in. A few friends had joined by this point. I'd pulled a big all-nighter, so I was been like riding for 36 hours as I was finishing, so things were getting silly, you know, that way things were like really silly. And I was like coming to the end and I was like, I've done it. Like I knew that I'd actually done it. And it was such a surreal feeling, like when I came under the Brandenburg Gates, they've got this great big pillars. You know, I think there's like five of them, like there's five sort of archways that you can go under. And I cycled under them and I had quite a few people on bikes around me at this point. And I just heard the cheering and the Scotland St. Andrew flags being waved all around, and just went straight over, saw my sister, locked eyes with my sister, and was just like, I just couldn't quite get my head around, like, it was like they were all made of cardboard. That's the only way I can explain it. It's like they were there. I recognize them. I know it's real, but I can't quite touch them. I can't quite feel it, you know? And it was just this like surreal sort of moment that you are beyond ecstatic, but equally just like no idea what's just happened.
Well, you know, it's taken you some time to take all your notes, to go back over the entire event and to write this book. And what's so interesting is that it feels like the book is happening while you're writing. It's like you're writing the book while you're writing because of the way you sort of detail each entry. You know, it talks about how many kilometers you've ridden in total, how many you rode that day, what day it is, the time. I mean, it's really well documented. And still so entertaining, if not harrowing and terrifying on some level. So what are you going to do now? It's like, oh, you've already ridden around the world. By the way, we should say that you smashed the record by how many days?
20 days.
Yeah, 20 that's days. A lot. Almost 3 weeks.
Days. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what's next? That's the big question, isn't it?
Yes.
The book, yeah, the training and riding and recovering took a couple of years, and then the book took a couple of years. And so now I've got this, like, I'm in this beautiful space of I've done the things, you know, and it's so I've got that sort of personality that I'm constantly thinking of the next thing. And I'm just stopping myself right now. And I'm like, no, just take this in. Don't race on to something new. You know, just I feel this like real contentment right now, which feels really, really nice. I've got lovely work coming up over the summer. You know, I make cycling documentaries, I'm going to festivals, I've got some tours planned with friends, but it's all like friend stuff, you know, it's all just like reconnecting and sort of just doing a little bit lower key, I suppose, a little bit closer to home. But like I say, my brain, I literally have to stop my brain thinking of like going to the moon every day. And so so I'm sure I'll come back with some harebrained idea. But right now I'm trying to stop it and just enjoy it.
So the last thing is, how can people get a copy of your book? It's published by Bloomsbury, and I love them. They do lots of cycling books. They're a wonderful publishing house. Coffee First, then the World. I assume that it's on all the usual places like Amazon and in bookstores and any place else?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's on, I've got a website, jennygraham.com. And it's, so there's all links on there, or like links on my social medias and stuff, but also like all the big internet giants and local bookshops will be stocking it across the States. It's on Audible and it's on Kindle too. So it's everywhere.
Who recorded your audio?
I did.
Good for you. I've always wanted to try that, but it's like, yeah, I do a podcast. I don't know if I want to do a book.
You'd be great at that. Oh, my goodness. You'd be so good.
Oh, thanks.
I find it so hard.
We'll see. After 12 years and almost 13 years, it's almost been 13 years. Well, Jenny, this is just, I'm so excited. I was really excited to be able to talk with you. I didn't know how much time you'd have. And I rarely do a full hour with somebody, but we could probably just talk all day and get a cup of coffee and do all of that. Jenny Graham, she smashed the world record Guinness book. And it is a Guinness record. It is in the books. Around the world on Little Piggy, by Shand Cycles in Scotland. The book is Coffee First, Then the World. Buy a copy, read it. It's so good. And thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
My thanks to Jenny for speaking with me today. If you think for a moment that Jenny's going to sit still like this and talk, I might suggest you think again. But I really appreciate that she spent this time with me. I did love the book, and I highly recommend it. You can follow Jenny on social media or check out her website, jennygraham.com. You can find copies of her book, Coffee First, Then the World, in all the usual places. Many of the companies Jenny talked about in our conversation are linked on our website, outspokencyclist.com, along with my show notes and some of the photos she shared with me. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with another episode soon. You can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and our website, outspokencyclist.com. And please remember to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. I hope you're having a great summer. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.